Hometown Alaska. I'm Charles Wolforth. Well, the dust is settling. It takes longer to settle in Alaska than most places, I think, and we still have several races that are not entirely decided, including the selection of our next governor. But there's also a lot that we do know from the election that was just completed and the ballots that were counted last night. And so our topic today is the election of 2014, what it means for Alaska, what it means for political insiders and outsiders, for the state, and for, of course, the federal elections that took place. And I've got two guests with me today. Eric Croft, who was a 10-year member of the Alaska State House, ran for governor, is now on the Anchorage School Board, is not currently a candidate, not running for mayor.
Not running for mayor, nope.
Right, so he's here for the Democratic side as an analyst. And Ralph Samuels, who was in the State House for 6 years, was a majority leader and was also a candidate for governor at one time. And Ralph is on his way here in the car. He had an engagement that went a little over, and we expect him in the studio any minute now.
But I've volunteered to speak for him. I've known it a long time. So you'll hear me in a different voice say a bunch of Ralph Samuels' opinions.
I'm sure he'd really be down with that.
Yeah, yeah.
So he's going to be representing the Republican point of view. He'll probably be a bit more cheerful than Eric. And so that's our thing today, is the political junkie thing. And we already have one caller, and we're looking for a lot more because I know everybody has an opinion on this big election that just took place, which seemed like it went on forever. And if you want to get on the air, the number here is 550-8433. From outside Anchorage, you can call toll-free at 888-353-5752. And the email address is hometown@alaskapublic.org. That can be a good way to get on the air if you don't have time to wait on hold. So, Eric Croft. The story seemed to be told that we had a national Republican wave election, pretty typical for a midterm election in the second term of a president, that it should go to the other party. The U.S. Right. Senate changed hands. Did that wave include Alaska?
Well, yeah, I think it did. And, you know, we often blame some of this on when we see results like this coming across that we're influenced by it. It seemed to be a wave that just we were part of rather than that swept over us. I think when it's happening in Maryland and Maine and North Carolina, and it's happening here and it's happening in the middle of the country, it was part of that wave. It's sad for Senator Begich. He kind of came in on the 2008 Obama wave, even though he's facing you know, an icon of Alaska politics, and out on a different wave.
So you don't think there's any chance that he's going to make up because he hasn't conceded the race yet?
Yeah, I don't know, and they've got better number counters than me. It seems a big hole. I do know that he
I guess he's behind by about 8,000 votes.
8,000, though. I saw him election night 6 years ago when it looked dismal, and he had a path then to explain it. And so maybe there's a path here.
I think he made up about 6,000 votes from election night till the final count in 2008.
So yeah, I'm not counting him out. I do know he ran a fabulous race, and we saw more. Of course, everyone knows that. We saw a bunch of money in the fight over the initiative, a bunch of the oil tax money fight, and. Now, and just tremendous money in this. It seems like we're all ready for it to have ended from a summer and a fall.
It got pretty crazy. Yeah. Well, I guess this was a $50 million race, $200 a vote, just unprecedented. Sure. And I assume that that's because the U.S. Senate was in the balance. I don't think that's going to be something we see again very frequently unless we are again in this position, which seems very unlikely.
Well, it's the fundamental evil, I think, in politics, sort of gerrymandered districts and too much money, particularly money that's not raised by the candidates. When the legislature doubled the amount of money you could put in to campaigns from 500 to 1,000, we did an initiative to put it back. I continue to think you get better elected officials when I have to knock on your door, ask for your vote, talk to you about the issues, and when I have to get it in $100 or $500 or $50 chunks than somebody writing a $10,000 or $1 million check. Now, not to your campaign, but just to some group.
Right. Well, the local and the Alaska campaign finance laws seem almost irrelevant in this era when many, many millions can come from a single individual and just dump into the race. And that's right. Where most of this was coming from. It wasn't coming from $500 that individuals give within the system.
Right. It sounds almost silly to be proud of doing that when it's just swamped over, irrelevant, made irrelevant. Yeah.
Yeah. So I've just received a text to the effect that, in fact, Senator Begich made up 7,400 votes in 2008, going from the election night count until the final count. So he's behind now by, 8,000, a little more than 8,000.
Yeah, you were saying 78 maybe? Anyway,
I mean, it's not impossible, but it seems quite unlikely. The governor's race is much closer between Bill Walker and Sean Parnell, with Walker up by about 1%.
And let's give Alaska its due here. When we were talking about swamped and national trends and national money, Alaska can still be unique. We did a weird one there, right? We get some additional weird points for all the things that happened in that race.
Right. So at the last count that I see on the Division of Elections website,
Stop speaking for Ralph now. I'll just speak for me.
Walker Malott is up by about 3,000 votes over Parnell Sullivan, and of course I don't have the information as to where the extra votes are coming from. I'd like to welcome former Representative Ralph Samuels to the studio. We already introduced you, Ralph.
Thanks. Thanks. Sorry I'm late.
Thanks for rushing across town to get here. I think last time we did this, Eric was late, so we still have partisan balance here. So I'm imagining that you're feeling a lot more cheerful than Eric this morning.
Depends. Yeah, you know. Election days are always
painful.
He's
just being nice. Go ahead, Ralph.
Yeah, go ahead and gloat. This will be your gloating period.
Next time,
Told you so.
Yeah.
The legislature is obviously going to be organized by Republicans.
You look at, you know, the two races that people considered in play, and both, quite frankly, were pretty wide margins, particularly that Turnigan, Sand Lake, you know, where Mia beat Claire.
So that would be 14
points, I think.
Right.
So
Mia Costello was moving up from the House to the Senate, and the Republican and challenged by Claire Ross, and big race, lots of spending, lots of effort, but in the end, it was a pretty wide margin.
It was a pretty wide margin, and then the race kind of that was in play was Kathy Giesel and then former Representative Crawford, mm-hmm. That was, I think, 10 points. So he got 14-6. So from a legislative point of view, the Republicans had a pretty good day.
Do you feel that reflects the national trend?
It's at the end of the day, we're a conservative state, you know, and people don't like, you know, I wish we had elections where you didn't put the RD next to your name kind of argument. But the reality is, if you don't get to know the person, it's kind of a barometer on their general value set. And Eric can tell he doesn't agree with every Democrat on everything, and I don't agree with every Republican on everything, or the platform and the party and all that kind of stuff that I don't think either one of us have ever been that engaged with. But generally, it's a Republican state, and I think that probably showed in this election, probably less than the national trend. You know, Senator Begich had the wrong president for his reelection.
Yeah.
You know, quite frankly, you wonder, does that
How does that play if George Bush, as close as it was, right? I mean, if it had been not, if the president had been, you know, you could see counterfactuals all day long. But if you figure that the Republican thing nationally with Obama's unpopularity, say if that just added 3 points, well, that's still that would still probably do it.
Yeah, we'll see how it ends. But yeah. I think the split on the absentees probably ends up about the same as it is right now. I mean, generally, unless you have an unusual thing. The Stevens Begich race, where the military kind of said, we're not voting for Stevens this time.
Right.
And the absentees came in way swinging one way. I would guess the absentees swing as the split is swing slightly for Dan Sullivan.
Yeah.
So explain the issues. I think you're absolutely right. I agree with everything except how did they vote liberal on all the issues and conservative on all the candidates? You know what I mean?
So the initiatives.
Minimum wage, the Pebble Mine, and AO-37.
The Pebble Mine, if you look at the campaigns against these things or for them, either way, the money that got spent, nobody spent money on the minimum wage. It polled. It was going to pass amongst Republicans, certainly amongst the Democrats. Nobody spent money fighting the Pebble Mine. Nobody. Not Pebble. Mm-hmm. They didn't spend any money saying vote no on four, mm-hmm. right? Pot they did, and of course it was a lot closer. And my view, Alaskans tend to hate big things. They don't like big government, which is why you get a libertarian Republican streak. They don't like big companies either. They don't like, you know, a big oil company or a big mining company. They tend to want to have small things. And the dichotomy for me as a business guy is in order to develop natural resources, you need companies with a lot of money to build a mine or drill a well or those things. So it's some kind of a yin and yang right there on big things. And I think it shows in the ballot measures.
But I mean, it is interesting that we have a, for example, a minimum wage issue, which passed everywhere it was put on the ballot. Yep. And Republicans generally have been against minimum wage increases. And the Republicans do really well, and the minimum wage initiative does really well. Just an interesting thing, and I don't quite get it.
There has to be a lot of people out there voting for the minimum wage increase and for a candidate who is opposed to the minimum wage increase. Right?
But nobody came out against, candidates didn't, no organized group did, no business group did, nobody came out against the minimum wage.
Yeah,
nobody fought it. I mean, if there were some philosophical people, they're going to argue against one or other, but nobody came out with an organized
campaign. Don't you think they did that? We did a show on it 2 weeks ago, and they had a heck of a time getting somebody to come in to be the advocate against it.
Yeah.
Let's go to a caller. Gene is calling from Anchorage and has been very patient. Gene?
Oh, hi. Thanks a lot. I agree with what you said about the ballot issues and the Senate race. It's like there were people went in and voted for some things and then just didn't vote, or voted for one but not the other. I'm actually originally from a blue state, and now I live in a red state. So seeing the pot issue pass and the minimum wage issue pass, that gives me some hope. But I'm curious why, well, two things. The House race didn't get reported on a lot, and I thought that was real interesting with Boris Dunbar, and also Lisa Murkowski's involvement. As soon as I saw her come out for Dan Sullivan, I thought, oh, she's showing up the right, because she did, because she really voted a lot with Begich. They were kind of, to me, both sides of the same coin, or two sides of the same coin. But her coming out for Sullivan, kind of she was thinking to when she's running and getting opposition from a Tea Party candidate.
Yeah, well, we'll take those questions, Gene, and I'm going to repeat them because the audio quality is not too good on your line. First was asking about the Don Young Forrest Dunbar race that Gene feels like it didn't get much coverage. It seemed like some of Young's faux pas that he had towards the election got a good deal of coverage, and that race ended up being closer than it usually is. I think that Dunbar, as a young guy without much of a political record, did at least as well as some of the political old hands that have been going against Young. And I have to think that that's because of some of Young's comments. Ralph, I mean, what did you...
Yeah, and what I was told, I wasn't there, but what I was told that what Don Young said at, I think it was Wasilla, at the high school, was
Palmer,
he said, I had a nephew who committed suicide, and I wish I had done more. And then he went into the faux pas, and the press jumped on the faux pas. So that is what I was told he was said, was there was more to it, and they took something a little bit out of context. And the reason it doesn't get the press is Begich Sullivan just sucked the air out of the room.
Right. The governor's race wasn't getting pressed.
The governor's race wasn't getting pressed. Even towards the end, it started to. But you can't buy any time on radio. You can't buy any time on TV. Your mailbox is full. It is pro-Begich, anti-Begich, pro-Sullivan, anti-Sullivan. They sucked the air out of the room with the – I mean, it's $50 million, I think. $50 million. Dollars. And everybody else looks at this and goes, well, Don's going to win. Whatever, Don's going
to
win.
Right. And it's really tough for a guy who's never run before, a young person, to beat an incumbent. To get 40% is pretty impressive.
Well, and I was just looking at it here, and Jim McDermott, the Libertarian, got 8%, essentially 7.5%. And so I think you're seeing a lot of people who couldn't vote for Forrest, couldn't vote for the Democrat, or didn't know Forrest well enough, even though I thought he ran a good campaign, but who had come off Young. So that's... You know, that's low numbers. You say 40, but Young only got 51.5, really. It's I think you're starting to see I don't want to vote for Don anymore, but I can't quite get myself all the way over to the opponent.
Or at least for 5% of
that's
people.
That's what the guy thought after John Devens.
We
keep thinking this will be...
He's a zombie movie. We bury him and he keeps coming out of the grave. He's not going to stop.
He seems to know how to win elections.
Yes,
it's Hometown Alaska. I'm Charles Wolforth. We're talking about the election just passed with Eric Croft and Ralph Samuels taking the Democrat and Republican point of view. Either could run for something in the future. Eric's currently the president of the Anchorage School Board, but as far as I know, neither is actually running for anything.
Are you running for anything?
I am not running for
anything. There you go.
And Eric has broken news. He's not running for mayor. So
we got that all out.
And I'm not running for anything either. So okay, we're just good. Having a conversation.
We're the has-been team.
So Gene also raised the point about Lisa Murkowski's endorsement. I don't think it was too surprising that she would endorse Dan Sullivan.
No, she's the most popular politician in the state by I imagine, leaps and bounds. And it's funny, Alaska, right? She is. We know Lisa and know why that would be. She's the most popular politician and lost her primary last time. You know, so we have such a strange state that way.
Well, she's closer to the middle, I think, than the core voter in the Republican primary. You probably agree with that.
I think that the issues that she is passionate about, the EPA coming in on several different fronts, hurt Democrats across the board in Alaska. It doesn't matter if it's and you can stay away from the Pebble Mine, but they had the situation at the mine up in Chicken. Mm-hmm. They have, should they preemptively come in and do things? They have a lot of different things that the EPA did that I think in a lot of Western states they fear. And it's not just the miners up here that fear. If they could do it there, are they going to do it to my project? And there was a lot of fear. And, you know, Mark came in and he just didn't beat them enough, or when he got elected the first time, he said, I'm going to go back to D.C. and I will be the guy, and I'll go beat on Obama and we'll stop some of the stuff, and it didn't work. He didn't stop it even though he was in the majority. So I think a lot of voters looked at those on the business issues, setting aside the social issues and different the business issues, then the key then is you need to take the control back. You need to win the United States Senate back if it's the only way to stop, you know, what you would consider an extreme environmental point of view from the EPA coming at it.
Isn't it odd, Eric, that we can do that, that Ralph said, setting aside the social issues, and we all seem to nod and say, yeah, you can do that, when 4 years ago, most of our political life, social issues were driving the bus, were at least huge, and you had to worry about them.
A lot of that's been resolved now. Gay rights
is probably over.
Yeah.
It seemed like it was hot for a while.
Abortion will probably never go away.
Not completely, but it doesn't seem to be a sort of a hot driver at the moment. Yeah.
When the
so
Colorado
let me get out
Republican...
the phone number so we can let people join our conversation. The number here, if you're in Anchorage, is 550-8433. 550-8433 to get on the air with myself and Eric Croft and Ralph Samuels. Outside of Anchorage is 888-353-5752. And the email is hometown@alaskapublic.org. I want to make sure we get the governor's race here before we get too far down in the hour. Really unusual race.
Right.
And very close. And I think the National Guard scandal issue has got to be the main driver of that outcome. I'm interested in your perspective, Ralph and Eric.
Oh, yeah.
Who wants to take that one first?
Well, no, I think it was this bleeding wound. I mean, it wouldn't stop. It was bad, but you can sometimes contain a bad, but it just kept going. And the other thing you do in crisis management, right, is you want a clean story that people can understand and that's believable. And it seemed to keep changing out of Parnell's office. So I think that had a big amount. It's almost as though we have the Republican Party, and the only way you can beat it is with everybody else. And they're the everybody else ticket, right? They're sort of Native Alaska and...
Walker and Milat.
And Walker, yeah, it combines. I was sign-waving with them, with this libertarian, you know, guy who loved Walker for some other reason, and then some Native people. And it was an odd mix that I don't think you get normally. I know you don't get normally.
Ralph, what did you think about the impact of the National Guard issue?
I think it obviously played into... I mean, we all knew this one would be close. You know, if you look at the Walker Milat ticket, they're going to get all the Democrat votes, right?
Mm-hmm.
You know, I will vote, and then you get some of the I hate the governor so bad, I'll vote for another Republican for him. And then you've got a certain amount of these people that Bill had in 2010 in the primary that follow him. And you get this sliver of Republicans that move over, right? And you're really fighting, they're in Walker's camp, and you're fighting over another sliver that's moving back and forth that generally are going to vote Republican. Generally, they're going to vote that way. And you look at it now as Eric said, is you've got the libertarian guy who supported you, and you've got what I would call the urban liberals who supported you, and you got the more rural people who are more practical in their politics than anybody else. And when you start to govern
What's his base?
It becomes problematic as, well, who are the commissioners? Mm-hmm. You know, do you have commissioners that philosophically disagree with each other because you had to give something, you know?
I think that would be refreshing.
It's
I think it would be really neat.
Coalition governorship.
Right,
yeah.
To have
a new creature.
A you know, Ralph is the commissioner of commerce and Real Greeny is the environment. You guys fight it out in cabinet.
It depends if you want something done or not.
Right.
Because if everything dies, you can't even get it out of your government.
Out
so
of your cabinet?
You and I, we get along fine. We're friends, right? Right? Mm-hmm. But we don't agree on a lot of things. So if Eric's in charge of one department and I'm in charge of another, and you need both departments for something to happen, nothing's going to happen. Because I'm...
Well,
I'm
now, wait a minute. I like the Department of Environmental Conservation Conserving the Environment and the Department of Economic Development Developing the Economy. And I would think you... You're right. It may not work.
We're the extreme.
And now we're totally speculating.
Extreme greedy in the DEC, and they go, "We're not going to develop anything."
We will see what governor apparent governor elect Walker comes up with. But now we've got a caller who is actually the I said apparent the brother of Senator Begich. Tom Begich is on the line. Thanks for being with us, Tom.
Hey, glad to be on. Glad to be talking with all three of you. So
we were throwing around some numbers in Senator Begich's race, and the question, is it over or is it not over? Did you want to weigh in on that?
Yeah, of course I do. But I wanted to say just a couple quick things first. And, you know, I noticed Ralph mentioned, you know, focused on the Senate and the change that occurred with the loss of one seat in the Senate for the Democrats, but he didn't focus on the House. I did want to point out that there are now three fewer Republicans in the House. And according to most Republicans, if you count Jim Culver in that group, it's four fewer. So there, you know, there's a give and a take that occurs in this kind of an election. Also, it does look like, you know, as your guests have mentioned, that the Walker Malott ticket's gonna go ahead and triumph. And in the process of doing that, elect the first Alaska Native to a statewide office, which is something that, you know, is worth noting. You know, in our history, that's something worth noting. But talking just about my brother's race for a moment, the total numbers, I heard you giving different numbers. About 7,400 people shifted the vote total shifted by about 7,400 in 2008. And that those numbers included, you started out 3,400 or so down and ended up winning by about 4,000 votes in that race. Right now, we're looking at about 8,000 down. And back then, there were about 55,000 out, including question ballots. Right now, the estimates, there are about 49,570 out, including the question ballots. So you've got, you know, basically those numbers. But the one piece...
Did you say 49,000 ballots are out?
Yeah, well, what you have is you have 13,800 unmailed or not returned yet absentee ballots. You have 19,715 uncounted absentees. 2,650 uncounted early votes. And by the way, that 19,715 amount is the early vote and absentee combination in rural Alaska. And then you also have approximately 13,000 question ballots is the estimate that's being bandied about. It could be less, it could be more, because the division hasn't given a full count for that yet. So when you put all those together, it comes to just under 50,000.
Wow, that's a lot. I mean, when 226,000 total votes cast, I guess those are the ones that actually were counted on election night. Another 50,000 out there. I didn't realize it was that many.
Yeah, and that would be, but that would equal about the projected turnout of 52-53%, which would have been about 275,000 votes, which is what people were basically projecting for this high interest election. But I was going to say the difference here is in rural Alaska, in the 2008 election. Mark Begich, because Ted Stevens was still popular, achieved about a 55% margin. In rural Alaska this time, he's running about a 70 to 75% margin in each of the House districts. That makes a difference. It's a significant difference. Also, when you note that if you're looking at those absentees, Ralph mentioned, figured they were all pretty much pro-Sullivan. The areas that are left to be counted in the absentees include the three Kenai districts, but includes all four of the rural House districts have zero counted, and all three of four of the Southeast, including downtown Juneau, have zero counted in their districts as well. Those are the remaining outstanding absentee ballots of that 19,000. So I think you're going to see a dramatic shift. Will Mark win or not? I don't know. But what I will guarantee you is it's going to be at the very least a few thousand vote margin.
Hmm. Wow, interesting.
Feel
numbers.
Better already, Tom. Thank you. Tom Begich medicine for me. Yeah.
I mean, if there's that many votes out in rural Alaska, I would expect those to trend towards the Walker Mallott ticket. And I haven't actually looked at the precinct results, but I'm assuming the Walker Mallott ticket did better in rural Alaska.
Significantly better in rural Alaska.
All right, interesting. Ralph, do you have anything to?
No, he's obviously done more research. My gene jerk. And the only thing I looked at was in a House district, and they split. However, the general population split also. So I didn't do the cross tabs thing. As far as Tom's comment on the House, they picked up some seats, although Ortiz in Ketchikan was up 19 votes, if I remember correctly.
Landslide. That's Alaska landslide.
And I believe that Klayman, which I would consider, I thought Klayman would just win big. Eric and I talked yesterday.
Right.
And Dubé and Klayman is within 35 votes, if I remember
correctly. That one was very surprising. And that's the same district where we're talking about the Ross Costello race, where Costello did really better than I think
right.
was expected.
And where Claire really had to take Turnagain big because Sand Lake was going to mm-hmm.
go for it. Yeah.
Well, Marty McGee was a good candidate, too, against Liz Vasquez. And again, that was a big margin. So the West Anchorage vote was much more Republican than most people expected.
Right.
And I don't know why that would be, but other than just the general Republican trend of the whole election.
So on the House, I mean, the rough organization now is 23-17. Now you have Foster and Nagiak who very well might join the majority. Even if that happens, it's a 25-15. I don't know, been down so long, it looks like up to me. When I was serving, you know, that we had 12s and 13s, 15 where the majority doesn't have 27, and so you can
unless
stop
you
some things.
Well, how do you keep, I mean, you guys have both been in the legislature. How do you keep those minority members in the minority rather than joining the majority and going for committee assignments?
It's my experience, it has to be a two-way street. You know, you're not going to get somebody who you're adamantly, philosophically opposed to, whether you're Democrat in charge or Republican, mm-hmm. or somebody who's adamantly, Jim DeMint is not going to join a hard-over Democrat
right.
legislature. Or you know, you're not going to see some of the joining. So it has to be, the majority is going to have to want in there, and usually to increase their numbers, you can argue to get some diversity in the group, you know, so you can look better politically. But they have to want to come also. Lindsey Holmes came across last year as an urban legislator, which was unusual. It's usually the rural legislators who will come over. But it's got to be a two-way street, and there's a few magic numbers. The amount of people in your minority, if you get below 10, you're considered a faction and not a minority. You don't have to get any assignments on committees. You don't have to get anything because mm-hmm. you could have 10 factions of one. I think that 27 is a magic number. 27 two-thirds, if I remember correctly.
So, yeah, so there's
30.
A lot of procedural things that happen that two-thirds, it's much easier to operate
to
a majority.
Your agenda.
Yeah, when you to move your agenda along, set it and move it along. And yeah, the natives are almost in a different, the rural areas, but really native seats, almost a different, there's a long tradition of them making some sort of arrangement. I believe that's why we saw Lyman Hoffman supporting Sullivan, and the scuttlebutt is that he gets, you know, co-chair of finance out of that. It's as crude as that. But there was often...
So Lyman Hoffman, senator from Bethel.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And he made an endorsement of across party lines right at the very end.
Yeah. Right at the very end, and it kind of out of nowhere, and it but we'll see what happens in the organization. Yeah, I don't think the being a faction is possible in the House, really, but in
no.
the Senate it is. If both Lyman and Donnie leave, I think that leaves four,
they've
right?
They've had...
Donnie Olson from North Slope.
They had what would have been a faction, and I believe it was the House where they had... Actually, it was the Senate 16-4 when they had a coalition.
And they
treated them as if a minority, but they didn't get that seat on the Finance Committee.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And also the seats on the committee, if you get an extra seat on particularly it's about the Finance Committee, you know, can you draw one person over and say, hey, Eric, why don't you come and join us and I'll give you that seat on Finance and I'll get an extra seat on the Judiciary Committee and all these other committees that I can put my people that philosophically agree with me on. But as I said, it's got to be a two-way street. You're not going to invite somebody who who absolutely philosophically opposes the agenda that you feel is best for the state as a group.
Lescara is not going to be in there.
Lescara is not yeah. going to come in. No.
Sorry, Les. Tom
Beckett is still on the line with us. Any of you guys know any of the scuttlebutt as to who is organizing and how it might be coming together?
Well, they'll be meeting today. There was this idea that if both Claire and Harry Crawford, Claire Ross and Harry Crawford won, that would maybe be enough for some of the moderates on the Republican side on the Senate to do a coalition. Clearly, with these numbers, that ain't going to happen. So it's going to mm-hmm. be a pure organization in both the Senate and the House. It's just how much of a native component it has, I think, at this point.
Dennis Egan came over last time.
That's right.
That's right.
And he won big. He won with 70.
In the House, the Republicans have their own internal debate, not just between Speaker Chenault and Craig Johnson, but also there's a faction of the female Republican legislators that are really quite unhappy with the leadership process, and they've been looking at Tammy Wilson and Lynn Gaddis as third leaders, and are advocating quite strongly for their faction. They're holding together pretty strongly right now. So
that those are all meetings that will be taking place, presumably behind closed doors, and it all sort of pops out, and we get to find out about it later.
My advice to every group, whether it be a union or a business group, is stay out of it. Yes. It is their—
Dangerous waters.
It is their fight. I got my arm twisted one time, my very first election. I tell you, I got elected in 2002 for the House. I didn't know any political players. I could barely tell you what the Speaker of the House did or what the committees did. I didn't know anything.
I'll testify that. He was really ignorant.
I was green as grass. I was mad about a couple things in my government, and I ran for office and I won.
Right? You figured
and
I'm just it out
happy
pretty quick,
as, yeah, happy as a clam. And so my softball team buddies were down there at Election Central, and we're drinking a few beers, and all of a sudden a guy from a group comes up to me. And he is twisting my arm about who they want to be the Speaker of the House. And I've never forgotten it. 12 years.
Yeah.
I've never forgotten who did it, what they said, what they wanted.
It's mm-hmm. good. It's good political advice. But and I got the same advice. The minority is less intense organization. You're waiting to see.
Oh, that's not really true, Eric. That's not really true.
The groups think they can play, and nothing's more personal. Nothing's more, you're talking about where you fit in this and what seats you get, and so
it can be ugly. Well, thanks, Tom, for calling in. Thanks, Eric Croft and Ralph Samuels for being with us. We're going to take a short break, and we'll be back in just a few minutes. I'm going to be giving out the phone numbers for other folks who want to come in and draw and rap about the election, which is what we're doing today on Hometown Alaska. So stay with us as Hometown Alaska continues.
You're listening to Hometown Alaska from Alaska Public Media. The program repeats tonight at 9 p.m. on KSKA Anchorage and will not be taking phone calls. You can find Hometown Alaska on iTunes or listen at alaskapublic.org.
It's Hometown Alaska. We're talking about the election, which we just finished yesterday. It seems like it went on for a lifetime. And the results and the organization, the inside baseball, is our topic today. And Eric Croft, former 10 years in the Alaska State House, Ralph Samuels, 6 years in the State House, both have run for governor. Eric is on the Anchorage School Board.
We did similar.
rather forget that, perhaps. But we're not going to let you do that. Neither they've said are running for anything right now. So I brought them in as our expert commentators on the election to give both
Tom
sides.
Tom showed that I'm not much of an expert.
That was fascinating. I feel a lot better about it.
Tom's always got the number. So let me give out the phone number for folks who want to join our conversation, have questions or comments, things you disagree with or predictions. The number here is 550-8433. That's 550-8433. If you're outside Anchorage, it's 888-353-5752, and the email address is hometown@alaskapublic.org. And as the host, I have something I want to bring up, which I think is a unique and new thing about this election, which is that there was so much money coming from outside that all the TV spots got bought. Federal races can preempt other races. And essentially what I was hearing from local candidates is they either could not buy TV ads, or if they're available, the prices were prohibitively expensive, just way beyond anything that was meaningful. And so then you saw campaigns going to other forums. You saw lots of internet advertising and more direct mail and lit drops than I have ever seen. I'm just pounds and pounds and pounds of paper. Interesting phenomenon, and I just wonder how that may have affected the campaigns.
I think it affects from the legislator's point of view. It helps the incumbent because you've already got the name ID, so you don't have to go out there and buy it. There's nothing to buy, so if you work hard and walk door to door, and they work hard and walk door to door, and you're the incumbent, you have an inherent advantage on day one. You're ahead, as opposed to you get swamped with money and they've got the better TV ads, and all of a sudden they buy their name ID up to equal yours. The way that the system worked with the 50 million or whatever that the Sullivan Begich people spent, it helps the incumbent legislators because their name ID is already established. They've already been elected once.
And as a challenger, you almost have to convince people to fire the incumbent before they'll consider voting for you. So that's where the sort of the media campaign bring somebody down is important. And this year, incumbents did quite well.
And so it's compounded by the way we use TV. You're absolutely right. Agree. But you almost, to be a real challenger, have to be on TV. We get so much now. You know, it should be that I could read a piece or an article about you. But I noticed, you know, when I'd campaign, I could have knocked on the door twice and talked to him about an issue. And then when my TV started running, it was a totally different reaction at the door. It was as though I was a different, I don't know, it's like, oh, it's you. Well, it was me before, you know, but now you've seen my face on TV.
Your credibility, yeah.
It's almost like we expect that now. It's what a candidate
has to be.
You're
a star coming to the door now.
You're a star, and you're like real. You can be voted for. And
it's interesting that as the media landscape has changed and fewer people are watching TV, it still is playing this huge role. And people are still going to have to figure out in the future how they break into a race against an incumbent if that TV angle is really not working.
I agree with the way that media is changing in general, that will change. I mean, everything takes a little more time, but in the next, looks like the next decade, it will dissipate. And the problem with the way that we do now is you tend to read the things of the people you already agree with. So if I'm a Republican, I'm going to go advertise on a bunch of Republican blogs, and Eric's going to go to the mud flats and he's going to advertise there, and you kind of preach at the choir as opposed to the middle of the roaders who may not know what the right-wing or left-wing blogs even are because they get their news from some other source. So it becomes more difficult to find where these individuals are getting the news, as opposed to, I'm going to go advertise on Channel 2 and I got more money than you, I win.
Right. Hey, let's go to a caller. Sam is calling from Anchorage. Sam?
Hey. I was just wondering, I know you touched on this earlier, but I think it's frankly bizarre that as a state we approved three pretty progressive ballot initiatives in Anchorage, a fourth one, but at the same time, we voted against every single politician that was in favor of those, in favor of those initiatives, and for all the politicians that were against it. What's up with that? I can't quite figure it out.
Yeah, well, Ralph talked a little bit about that in terms of that there wasn't that much campaigning on most.
I don't believe that anybody came out, elected people came out against the minimum wage. I don't believe any did. I never saw a candidate for office.
It's chicken and egg, isn't it, Ralph? The reason they didn't is because it was overwhelmingly popular. And so the point is, why are the liberal issues and the conservative politicians popular? It was so popular that I think a lot of Republicans who privately would say they didn't want the minimum, or who had even voted in the legislature against minimum wages or to repeal them, didn't go out and campaign against it just because they thought it was a done deal.
It's a done deal.
Yeah.
AO37 is another interesting one in that, Mayor Sullivan sort of made this his legacy legislation. I mean, boy, did he poured everything into it and took a lot of risk and fought
and
it down to the
end. That was a bad move, right?
And now it's gone. And it doesn't seem like he's got anything left out of that.
And another sort of interesting thing about that and the governor's race, clearly Byron Mallott added a tremendous amount to that ticket. It made that ticket into something that could get near to 50%. You typically pick a lieutenant governor when you can pick them or try and support one that'll add something to the ticket. And I just think, setting aside any disagreements with Dan Sullivan, I just didn't think he added much different. Another Anchorage
Didn't hear too much about him. Yeah.
Yeah, and it didn't bring a regional or anything, and it brought some baggage as well.
Ralph, what was your read on the AO-37?
Yeah, I would agree with what Eric said. He didn't bring anything to the table. And the AO-37, once again, you had some op-eds by some. I saw one from Chris Birch and a couple of the people that had voted for it. I don't think the public understood exactly what it was, and the unions got out there and they made sure their people understood exactly what it meant to them.
Right.
I mean, and once again, it's the minimum wage thing. There's nobody really coming out saying vote yes. I'm not certainly not a lot of money compared to the flyers and the bumper stickers and the very, very big campaign, which then turned into votes for, you know, Mark Begich and Bill Walker also. So
yeah, interesting that I found it interesting when I actually got into the voting booth that the ballot question didn't even say what it was about. It just said, do you support this
shall this it AO-37 remain law
or not? And,
yeah.
And you really had to come into the booth with a lot of information, which obviously the opponents had. But the other thing it points up is that this was a great election for Alaska unions. I mean, the role that Vince Beltrami from AFL-CIO had in creating the unity ticket between Walker and Mellott, at least according to the media story out there, significant.
I was
right?
Like, if you were there, I wasn't. He well, says I mean, he didn't create it, but.
But he was in the paper saying that he wasn't going to give any money unless there was unity. There was unity, and then the unions put a lot of money into that race, which kind of Walker might have had a hard time raising in the short amount of time he had. And also AO-37 was another big win for the unions.
Oh, yeah. On some pretty mainstream issues, right? Or put another way, minimum wage is a mainstream issue that passed in a lot of different states, and AO-37 was kind of an overreach by Mayor Sullivan that got pushed back. That was a little too much. The marijuana did have a big organized anti that I thought did an excellent job, raised a lot of questions that you're worried about.
And normally I probably would have leaned to voting no, but I'm rather ambivalent. Personally, I'm just rather ambivalent about it. But then I went and saw the presentation from a gal who had been involved with in Colorado, and here's the problem. I mean, there's pictures of the vending machines and this and all this stuff. And you're thinking, maybe we'll wait and see how they do it on air. But the public, how many people go to presentation? How many people go to a debate even?
Right.
Where you see the candidates out there, certainly at a legislative level. I don't know. And as far as what the caller asked was the progressive ideas, I think Alaskans tend to be libertarian. They don't like the government, but they don't like the government telling you can't have your pot either. So they vote for the Republican, but don't tell me I can't have my pot. And the minimum wage one is one that is odd to me.
That's a government one,
because the
too,
government is mandating what you pay your labor force. So it's
most
you're
of
right.
You think of it from the paying the labor force. Most of me and most of the others think of it as what I get paid. So I guess it's which end of the check you're on, baby.
Well, let me bring it back to the marijuana initiative, because that's a pretty surprising one. Only state number three or four, depending on how you count Oregon. Huge, real social policy change.
Every elected official that I know of saying don't.
Nobody was for it.
Yeah, all the way across.
All sides.
Yeah.
And the police chiefs were against it, and there was an organized campaign against it. And the campaign for it had some missteps with the Charo Green incident and all that.
Which was great entertainment.
Oh, yeah. And the the rural Alaska saying, do we need another, and yet it passed, and with a significant, it passed convincingly, and now I guess we'll be.
Do we know in rural Alaska how it went? I'd be love to see that.
I saw a map that somebody put out, and I think instead of blue and red, it was like green. One was green. I can't, and I don't have a copy of it. But
you mean the pot areas were
the
green?
Pot areas
is that
were green,
what you're
saying? Yeah.
Okay. How does a Governor Walker or a Governor Parnell implement this thing? This seems like a big challenge, and with a lot of pitfalls for them.
Yeah. Yeah. And similar reaction to Ralph on this, or I guess I started thinking that I was for it, but the more I heard about it, the more worried I got. So you said you a sort of slight no to a hard no. I was maybe a slight yes to a And I think, initiatives are built to address issues that the politicians won't for whatever reason. Special interests got them too bought, or they just disagree with their public on it. And then there is a mechanism for the legislature then to modify it. They can't repeal it, but they modify it. So maybe it's a rough justice in the sense that they said what they wanted, the people, and now the legislature gets to shave off some of the edges that are most troubling.
Colorado's got a worse problem. I mean, I shouldn't say it's a problem.
Because it's constitutional.
Yeah. It's constitutional there. Mm. So every time that they've tried to push a regulation for it, they're getting litigated against. And I don't think that flies here.
Oh, it doesn't. It's a very important. I'm a big initiative guy, but our framers said no constitutional amendments by initiative, and I thought that was wise.
It's Hometown Alaska. My name is Charles Wolforth, and my guests today are Eric Croft and Ralph Samuels, representing two points of view, although they seem to agree quite a bit.
Yeah, we got to stop that, Ralph.
The Democrat and Republican point of view on the election that just passed. And if you'd like to join our conversation, the number here is 550-8433, 550-8433. Outside Anchorage, it's 888-353-5752. And the email is hometown@alaskapublic.org. And I just want to finish talking with the initiatives before we take a couple of calls. So we have the Pebble Mine. The investors dropped out of it. Litigation went on. It's become less and less popular. And then we have this vote, which seems like it puts the final nail in the coffin, because it's hard to believe anybody coming in and investing in this mine when you've now got a vote of 65% of Alaskans essentially saying no. What do you think, Ralph? Is that how you read it?
Yeah, it's... What the initiative did, and the problem I've got with the initiative is, most initiatives are to avoid the legislature because the legislature's not doing what a group, an individual, thinks that they should do for whatever reason, and you're going to try to go straight to the people. Here, you tried to bring more politics into it, and the fear would be, as you look at this strategy, this requires legislative approval. Well, the next time it's going to be an oil well. Now I need legislative approval to do anything in NPRA. Now I need legislative approval to do anything there. And if the legislature did pass a law that I can drill a well here, I mean, you're looking at the consequences 15 years from now, not next year or the year after, but 15, 20 years from now, as you're setting public policies, you go to the legislature, and even if you get the permit, you go through this permitting process that you've got. You go to the legislature, you get them to pass a statute, and some guy with $20 million of his own money writes another check and have an initiative to overturn that statute, and you're back at square one. So it's a bit of a chilling effect. The process...
A hypothetical guy with $20 million bucks?
A hypothetical guy with $20 million.
I see.
You know, and all of a sudden is that wasn't the intent of the initiative process to try to add this on there. The other point that I made and... is if you do this there, I'm from King Salmon. I grew up in King Salmon. And so the Naknek River, the most prolific salmon stream in the planet right now, arguably the most prolific salmon stream in the planet. If they're going to build a dock in the Naknek River and they've got to drill pilings and they've got to fill here and fill there, do they need legislative approval also? It's the most prolific salmon stream. I mean, where are you going to draw the line? And it's all focused on this one. But now you've set this precedent. You got a few more ideas for some outside groups that might see mischief to stop development here, stop anything that they don't want up here. So it's if you look at it outside the context of Pebble Mine, it's a bit troubling to me that you see the road that you go down with a new idea for the initiative process.
Although it is interesting if this big debate we've had about Pebble over the years has now... one side has won, and we really don't need to talk about it anymore in terms of when you have a two-thirds vote. So let me go to caller David, who's calling from Anchorage. David?
Hey, how's it going, fellas?
Hey, good.
I was kind of curious what one of your callers had called about. I actually got to work. I'm a branding consultant, and I worked on four on the campaigns, two of them a significant kind of role. And it was interesting to watch how these liberal initiatives get passed, but these conservative politicians get elected, and kind of that paradox. And a colleague and I were having a conversation about today, and we were talking about why that is. And from my perspective, I always come back to this idea of branding. One of you was talking about how people are only speaking to their audience now. I actually believe, and I think that the kind of social, you know, psychological studies that are being done by universities in terms of media consumption have actually caused our society, especially in the urban part, in Anchorage and Fairbanks and Juneau, has caused the general population actually can't listen the same way anymore. They don't have time with their jobs and their careers and their kids and everything to go and actually educate themselves in all the areas and see where their politicians link up. They don't have those conversations with the politicians themselves. it is people backing into their corner, speaking from their audience. It's tribalism, essentially what it becomes. And when you get into the booth, it becomes what tribe they want to be. And each thing, oh yeah, I want to be, you know, yeah, no, minimum wage, yeah, we got to do that. That makes sense because it makes me feel good. But I'm going to kind of go with what I know, and it's not. I guess it's more of an abstract process, and I think that's the only thing that we can come to that we can try and explain why we have this weird paradox in terms of the kind of the voting public, and it's a real quandary for, you know, especially officials that want to try and unseat a conservative incumbent to try and link people up and help. You have to do so much education of the public to try and link all these things up and say, yes, no, if you vote for this guy, if you vote for a Lance Pruitt, say, he's pro-Pebble Mines. So don't mark that thing pro-fish if you're going to go, you know what I mean? If you're going to go.
Oh, yes, let's talk about part.
Oh, the branding is huge. And
the Democrats don't seem to have a very good brand in Alaska.
The Republicans do a much better job nationally of a simple brand, an understandable brand, and it plays better up here. I've been a NRA member and a gun rights supporter all, but like Republicans don't believe that. They don't sort of, I've been a hunter and everywhere. It takes some convincing at the door because it doesn't fit the brand that they expect. Kinda.
Same with baggage, yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Ralph?
I think that if you look at nationally, you know, speaking as the Republican guy here, is you hear about the Tea Party in the press, right? Mm-hmm. That faction of the party. Up here, you don't hear it labeled as much, but you look at the environmental faction of the Democrat Party. You kind of got the unions and you got the environmentalists. Those are the two. And most times, to me, they should be diametrically opposed. Not the public sector unions, mm-hmm. but the working trade unions, they should be diametrically opposed. And yet I would come back in the collar and say it's the same exact thing there. Is the environmentalists, you say you're every Democrat I've ever seen their flyers, they're pro-business. Every single one. And you look and go, no, you're not.
Right. Yeah, no, exactly right.
But it cuts
the same process.
It cuts both ways.
Totally.
On the message, and if you look at you've got the social conservatives and the Republicans, I mean, and there's far more factions in this. The social conservatives, their passion is on social issues. Mm-hmm. And then you've got people like me, your Chamber of Commerce, Republican, pro-business guy. And for the Democrats, they don't have the problem nationally of, well, you're the greenie Democrat as opposed to the union Democrat. You don't have that problem nationally because the press has said the Tea Party guys are a bunch of wackos and they're over here. But to me, those are the two factions over there.
Yeah. Well, you've got two parties, so you've got to put together these coalitions.
If you look at Representative Smith or Jones, and you say, well, he voted, he's pro-Pebble, and they go, you know what, I don't like Pebble, but I don't really care that much. It's mm-hmm. like, you know, that's not my issue. My issue is X. My issue is I'm not voting for you damn Democrats always.
Or that
welfare state, you're ruining my life, blah, 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 whatever.
He looks like me. I like the same music. I sort of, that's me.
I like him.
Right, I like him.
He's a nice guy. And quite frankly, Eric and I would probably agree on this. You know, we're supposed to start disagreeing, by the way.
Oh, we'll try.
When you go door to door, you don't want to talk issues. Yeah. You do not want to.
Talk about their garden, talk about their dog.
You just want to be a nice guy.
That's right. Hey, thanks for the call, David. We're now going to go to Carly, who's calling from Anchorage and has been very patient. Carly?
Hi, thank you. I really don't want to give Don Young any credit for this. I think it may be more just due to his attitude and demeanor. But I think one of the things that really hurt Forrest was Don Young's failure to engage with him till such a late point in the cycle when we'd already been being bombarded by these messages from all these other campaigns. And for him to not have that first chance to meet until October, I think was really unfortunate, because then at the time that Don Young made his missteps in the Valley, people kind of still weren't really sure who Forrest was, which is unfortunate because he's got a fabulous background. And I was just curious, I think, if anyone else felt that same way.
Yeah, if you hadn't had a Senate and a governor's race, if this had been the marquee event, do you think it would have come out differently because it would have had more attention?
Well, he and I were just nodding and known each other long enough to thinking that was Don Young's job. It was not his job to give Forrest. It was
Why
smart. I don't want to give Don Young any more credit either to the caller, but I think that was a wise incumbent move. He's got the ground to his liking, and he doesn't have to.
Young would have probably done better if he never had spoken to the public,
right?
Because he put his foot in his mouth a couple times in a big way.
I know we're running out of time. I wanted to do the bar owner aspect of this whole thing. That's what hasn't been covered. We have two I think...
What are you talking about?
Bar owners are popular in the state. I got two data points for that.
Stutes and wool, both.
That's Stutes and wool. So wool up in Fairbanks. And he added ice cream to it. I think that's a deadly... Own a bar.
And he was a surprise Democrat who won in the sort of Salcha outside of Fairbanks area.
And he ran such a good campaign that by the end, I think people were predicting it. But at first, it seemed weird. And so he won maybe in a surprise. And then... It's Stutes.
Louise Stutes.
Who, against Jerry McCune, who's been a fish person in a fish community, you'd think that would work. I think bar owner, and certainly bar owner with ice cream, big thing in Alaska.
Yeah.
Big common thing. You heard it here first.
I was a little surprised that Jerry McCune lost, but then I don't know if the people like him.
You look at districts that have more than, Eric and I's districts, they're both homogenous neighborhoods. You know, one precinct, it might be a little different socioeconomically. You know, might have a little higher-end homes, a little lower-end homes. But it's just a homogenous. It's an Anchorage or Fairbanks district. But if you look at communities in Southeast where you represent, you know, Christ Tompkins beat Samuelson, but he's from Sitka. And Samuelson's from Petersburg. So the Sitka people know Christ Tompkins better.
Mm-hmm.
And in Kodiak, if you look at Jerry...
He's from Cordova.
From Cordova. Well, guess who has more votes in Cordova? Kodiak does.
We're supposed to disagree, so I'll disagree. I represented parts of downtown and parts of Spinard, baby. They're different. Spinard is different.
They're different, but it's not
Spinard
like...
Spinard thinks it's different.
Same media market, yeah. So, Gus got a couple of minutes left, and nobody ever talks about the judges, but I think that something interesting has been happening, which is that judges are starting to campaign, and Bill Estelle... had been given a negative recommendation by the judicial council, and then his friend sent out a bunch of flyers, and he won. Not he's about 10 points behind the other judges, but he's still in office. Interesting that judges are starting to campaign.
Yeah, well, this one I think can be explained on the merits. Now, maybe there's something else going on, but when I heard the judicial council had said that he was doing bad stuff and he was filing his forms when he shouldn't have been, that looked bad. I was probably leaning towards voting against him. Then I heard the explanation and it seemed to make sense. So to me, it sort of talked me back to why. I think this one's explainable by, sure, it's a bad thing to do that, but he had an appropriate explanation.
I wonder how many voters really followed
that much,
though. I bet there's a big random element in there of people just vote yes on all the judges.
Or no.
You
know, and I voted, I didn't vote on him. I'd read about it, but I didn't know enough about it.
Mm-hmm.
And I tended to, if I know them and I either like or dislike them, their policies or some of the rulings they've made, I will vote yes or no on them. But usually I leave them blank because I don't know enough. The candidates in my district, I know a lot about the candidates in my district. I know who I'm going to vote for the governor's race.
From the minute they file,
I go, oh, yeah, I know that guy. Yeah.
Yeah, now we got to listen to 6 months of campaigning, right? So I guess the next thing that happens is we find out who won the governor's race. I think it probably looks like Walker, and then we find out what kind of governor he's going to be, who's going to pick for his commissioners. And it's got basically 3 weeks to do that before, you know, that super fast process.
You don't have to pick the commissioners right away. You'll have, I would assume if Walker wins, he's got to have a couple of people in mind, kind of his core people. But you can go later into the process and take some time with that. And how the legislature organizes itself would be an interesting...
It is going to be an interesting month or so ahead for those who aren't so sick of politics that they can't stand it anymore.
Is anyone listening to us? You out there?
Right. Well, thanks both of you. Eric Croft, Ralph Samuels, always fun to have you in. Thank you for coming in again. Next week on Hometown Alaska, I will again be your host. And we're going to be talking about Alaskan playwrights. We have a playwright here in Alaska, David Holthouse, who has a play on off-Broadway that's been highly regarded by national critics. He's going to be in the studio, as well as Dick Reichman, another local playwright. Pat Yak is the Chief Content Officer for Alaska Public Media. Dave Waldron was our audio engineer. Thanks for joining us today on Hometown Alaska. I'm Charles Wolforth.
Hometown Alaska is a production of Alaska Public Media, which is solely responsible for its content. Views expressed are those of the host and participants and do not reflect the underwriters or KSKA. Hometown Alaska's theme song, Lead Dog, is by Kevin Barnett from Eagle River. Learn more about Hometown Alaska and listen online at alaskapublic.org. Life Informed. This is Alaska Public Media.